With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the CapEx podcast. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. It's not often we get bona fide political royalty on the podcast, but whatever your outlook, few people have bestrode British politics over the last few decades like Peter Mandelson. Mandelson's often credited as being the original spin doctor in the 1980s, but that rather glib epithet undersells his influence on the New Labour project, where he was integral to both Tony Blair's ascent to the leadership and the party's subsequent electoral success. He went on to serve in a number of cabinet roles and as a European commissioner before returning to government under Gordon Brown as business secretary and president of the Board of Trade. Since 2010, he has been the chairman and was co-founder of the strategic consultancy Global Council. Earlier this week, Lord Mandelson was one of the panellists at the Margaret Thatcher Conference on Trade, hosted by CapEx's parent organisation, the Centre for Policy Studies. I caught up with him afterwards to talk trade, Brexit, and how he sees his party's prospects under Keir Starmer. I began by asking Lord Mandelson where Brexit Britain's greatest opportunities are in trade and how we can gear up to make the most of them.
Well, as it's the Margaret Thatcher conference, I couldn't possibly overlook saying that the biggest, closest, most open, same standard market available to us, of course, still, is the European single market that, you know, Mrs. Thatcher was instrumental in creating. Now, we've left the European Union, obviously, having spent, you know, half a century integrating ourselves to that market. But the trade and cooperation agreement that we have between Britain now, the UK now, and the European Union is a dynamic one. And if we want to reopen the trade opportunities in Europe, we can do so by negotiating down many of the barriers that we've deliberately put in place since we left the European Union. Beyond Europe, we can look west and east. If we look west towards the United States, where we already have a vast amount of transatlantic trade and investment, we can seek to grow that trade and grow that investment, but we will not have the benefit, in my view, of a new trade agreement between the United States and the UK. That door is closed to us in the US, and I cannot see in the near future any American administration forcing it open. Then there's east to Asia, and that is a huge collection of different sized countries and markets, some bigger than others, some more pro-trade than others, some prepared to liberalise more than others. And I think that the Department for International Trade here in Britain has been right to prioritise the rolling over of the EU's agreements with such as Japan and South Korea and other countries, which we needed to have as our base, and are now, in a sense, looking from those agreements in Asia to the springboard of the revamped Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP, that consists of 11 Asia-Pacific countries. I think the government is right to make that a goal of trade policy here. We have to watch out that we don't end up paying twice for the privilege of joining the CPTPP, because we've already got bilateral agreements for which we have paid with a, you know, quite a number of its members, whether that be Japan or South Korea or Canada or Mexico. But I think that it gives us an opportunity to eke out advances and benefits in different sorts of trade, services, data, digital trade, for example, IPR, intellectual property right protections and consumer protections. I think we can do more if we're nimble in that negotiation, and that's what I believe the government is going to seek to do.
Do you see particular sectors where the UK has a particular advantage? You spoke then about sort of digital and services rather than, say, traditional manufacturing.
Yes, I don't rule out manufacturing, particularly as new markets and supply chains open up for us, for example, from the energy transition. We need to be market leaders in decarbonisation, because that's going to open up all sorts of new manufacturing and production opportunities, which, you know, we will seek to export as well. But services, yes, are going to remain very important for us, as will electronic commerce and everything that depends on the safe and secure exchange of data between countries cross-border.
Now, obviously, whenever you've been in government yourself for many years, you have to deal with governments and people you might not always see completely eye to eye on things. I mean, for instance, the Saudis, the Chinese, countries that don't have a democratic system. I mean, how important do you think it is that the UK pursues a kind of ethical trading policy or prioritises countries who share our values?
Well, it's likely that we're going to find it easier to negotiate agreements with like-minded democracies. I mean, those that are not democratic, autocratic, tend to be populist, nationalistic, anti-foreign business entities, and therefore, and more capricious, by the way, and arbitrary in the way in which they make and apply their policies. So they are not the easiest of negotiating partners for us. So I think we're most likely to veer towards other like-minded, market-based, more liberal democracies, and alliances or coalitions of such countries. Then you come to China. And, you know, China naturally excites a lot of concern about human rights in Britain, and not just in the UK. There we cannot ignore how goods are produced in some respects, and we're not. But remember that we are constrained by WTO rules. I mean, the government is utterly committed to free, fair, rules-based trade within the multilateral system. And the sort of core platform or foundation of the WTO and the rules-based system is that it operates a strict sort of non-discriminatory baseline of openness. So you have to be careful that if we start discriminating against countries because we don't like some of their policies or human rights or whatever, then we are liable, at least, to possible prosecution under the WTO rules. So we have to be slightly careful.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously you would rather we were still in the EU. That's not much of a secret to anybody. But how do you see the post-Brexit relationship with the European Union going now? I mean, I assume you're still in contact with plenty of people in Brussels and have an idea about how they feel towards us. Do you think we can get over the bad blood we see at the moment?
In time, yes. In time, yeah. We've got to. We don't really have an alternative. We can't just sort of ostracise ourselves in our own neighbourhood. You know, we can't just sort of permanently exclude ourselves from trade opportunities and privileges that we want to have access to in the, you know, biggest market, 450-odd million people in Europe, the biggest, the closest, the most open to us. So over time, we are going to want, inevitably, in my view, to row back on some of the trade barriers that we've rather, I think, stubbornly, rather artificially created for ourselves on grounds of national sovereignty. I think we should have been a bit more pragmatic, a bit more practical in our approach. And I think that that will, therefore, over time, serve us well if we were to mend fences and find a sort of a sensible partnership and re-establish the mutual, not just trade and economic benefits that exist between us and our neighbours, but also the security, the intelligence sharing, I mean, all the other areas of public policy where we would be mad not to want to create a sensible set of partnerships in these key areas with ourselves and our immediate neighbours who provide both the chance for us to combat better and collectively the threats that are posed to us, but also to exploit the opportunities that are available to us in economic and trade terms.
I wonder, just moving on from to sort of domestic scene, the government's big domestic project, if you like, is levelling up, which is a slightly nebulous term. And we've had on the podcast, we've had Philip Collins before, who said, well, we tried something pretty similar when we were in government. I wonder what your reflections are on what the government is trying to do and how similar it is to Labour's own efforts to regenerate kind of post-industrial areas of the UK.
Well, first of all, I think the government is right to set that as a key public policy objective. I think that the Prime Minister's commitment to and enthusiasm for levelling up is welcome and admirable. It is a Labour agenda that is being followed here by the last Blair and Brown governments. But I would say without the structural and institutional underpinning, which I think is necessary and desirable for the goal to be realised. I mean, institutional and structural underpinning both in Whitehall, but also in the regions where it needs to be successful. I mean, an enormous amount of money it is planned to throw at towns in the Midlands and the North. But I would say without the institutional means or plan needed to bring about what I think is indispensable, and that is a structural economic transformation of the northern part of the country, without which we can make things look better, but without them actually being different. And I think that's going to be the test for the government's levelling up strategy. Is it at the end of the day going to throw an enormous amount of money from the centre, by the way, because it's the centre, it's Whitehall knows best in the system that the government is creating. They're not devolving power or responsibility or money raising or local decision making, which I think is wrong, because I think regions and towns and communities need to accept and embrace responsibility for their own futures and their own welfares. But I think, secondly, there's a gap in the government's approach where an economic theory needs to be about how this economic transformation is going to take place. Because without that transformation, as I say, you can change how things look, but not necessarily how they are.
In political terms, do you think, you mentioned that you said that this is a Labour agenda, but this means that Labour itself has less sort of space to operate in. Where do you think they ought to be kind of pitching to the public, given that the government has what some people, even on the right, think is a sort of centre-leftish economic agenda?
I think the government, the Labour Party, in a very real sense, is going to have its approach made more credible. It's going to be legitimised by what the government is saying and doing. Now, what Labour has to do, though, is to put in place the institutional means and machinery and planning that will serve these goals and make them more, give them a greater, more realistic chance of being achieved. So the how, I think, is very important, and not just what, no, not the whether and the if, but the how. And Labour has got to step up with a much clearer set of policies, practical policies, which again set out the how of achieving these goals, rather than just the sort of rhetorical aspiration which the present Prime Minister is very good at articulating with his famous boosterism, but which leaves something to be desired in policy areas which frankly require more focus, more detail, more thrashing out of the mechanics, but also, as I say, that institutional underpinning of what they're trying to achieve, and not simply a Whitehall knows best attempt by ministers, you know, located in the levelling up department, just sort of pulling levers and pressing buttons and dispensing packages of money to those parts of the country, those communities, or indeed those currently Tory-held constituencies that are lucky enough to be the beneficiaries.
Yeah, I wonder what your reflections are, having been involved in strategy while Labour in opposition as well. You mentioned coming up with more detailed policies. I mean, when do you think they ought to kind of bring those to the public, to public attention? Because if they bring them out too early, isn't there a risk they kind of just get hammered?
No, I think that's a good question. My approach would be to set out direction, more broad brushstrokes. We have to have an idea, a sense of what exactly the political economy is that Labour now believes in. I mean, I think we had a fairly good idea what New Labour's approach was. That then became, frankly, very confused and very uncertain under Ed Miliband, who wanted to sort of repudiate New Labour without actually knowing what he wanted to put in its place. It then became clearer again under Jeremy Corbyn. I mean,
yeah, for better or worse.
with the result that we drove away vast swathes of the electorate who didn't want to vote for us because they saw only too clearly what his policies were. Now, what the Labour Party under Keir Starmer has to do is to come back, you know, onto the sort of centre-left political ground and be much clearer about the sort of political economy they want to see, the role of markets and the private sector in partnership with the state and government. I think we have begun to see that, incidentally, in Keir Starmer's speech to the CBI, where I think that his approach, frankly, would have gained probably a little bit more support than the sort of pantomime performance that the Prime Minister put on at the CBI. But we're at the beginnings of this in Labour's case. We're in the foothills now, and frankly, I think that Keir Starmer and his colleagues have just got to put on a little bit more speed, a bit more clarity, a bit more definition about the direction that they want to lay future Labour government to take, because it's not that far ahead of the general election. We're approaching a midpoint in this parliamentary term. So without setting out details and specifics at this stage, we do need more definition, we need more clarity.
I mean, how do you think, and you've kind of touched on it there in part of your answer, but how does he marry that essential question that Labour faces, which is how do we come up with an offer that appeals to our sort of metropolitan voters and the voters we want to either keep or win back in all those seats in the North,
but
the Midlands
been,
and
but
so on.
But that's been the coalition Labour's always won with. Mm-hmm. We won with that alliance, that nationwide coalition, if you like, of working class and middle class people, of northern constituencies and southern. We did so again in 1964, and we did so again in 1997. You know, it's not rocket science, nor in my view are the interests of working class and middle class people, those who live in the north or south, they're not opposites. You know, they are very, very similar. I mean, you know, what people want to see is a very strong government commitment to a growing economy where good, well-paid jobs are going to be created. They want safety in the streets and in their neighbourhoods, as well as security on our borders. They want high-quality public services, and they want to know that their children and their grandchildren are going to be able to get on in life and do even more than they had the chance to do when they were growing up. Now, that is what Labour's offer has got to be. That's certainly the vision, and it's got to be supported by a workable programme, which I think bit by bit Starmer and his colleagues now are putting in place. But I know from my own former constituency in Hartlepool that what people want is a mixture of idealism and competence and affordability. That's what they want from Labour, and it's not different from what people in London, Kent and the South West want as well.
My final question is just on this question of Labour's own sort of internal battles. I mean, how concerned are you that the kind of remnants of the Corbyn movement are causing the party a kind of reputational problem with certain voters? People keep popping up, especially on social media, and saying things that will put off a lot of the people that Labour needs to win over.
The problem for us in the Labour Party is that there isn't a party to the left of us to which the Marxists, the Trotskyists and the hard left would be revolutionaries can turn to instead. I mean, we are a broad coalition as a party. Rather, I might say, as the Conservative Party is a broad coalition. The Conservative Party now consists of, you know, both sort of internationalists and progressives and One Nation Tories, as well as populist nationalists and the rest. Boris Johnson's job is to get as many of them dancing together on the head of a pin as he can without toppling over. Well, what is true for the Conservatives is also true for Labour. We are, as I say, coalitions. I make no secret of the fact that I think that the ability of the hard left to inflict real damage on the Labour Party, as we've seen over very many decades, is considerable, which is why I think Keir Starmer is right to demand not just rule changes, but a change in the culture of the Labour Party that makes absolutely clear that whilst the core ministers, the hard left, yes, if they subscribe to our rules and our constitution, can stay in the Labour Party, but are no longer in the driving seat of our party. That is the case now. It's going to remain the case. I firmly believe, but I obviously have, no doubts about the damage they can do us when they pop up. But we just got to make sure that the public see that they're not in control.
That's all from me this week. But before I go, I just wanted to let you know about a live in-person event that's happening next Wednesday with the broadcaster, writer and commentator Ian Dale, who will be discussing his new book, The President, which is an anthology of all 46 men who have graced the White House. The event's at 5:30 next Wednesday, December the 1st, at our Westminster offices, and you can find ticketing details on the website, on our Twitter feed, and in this week's editions of the CapEx newsletter. And if you're not a subscriber to that, just go to www.capex.co/subscribe. Hopefully I'll see you there. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.